For War News Radio at Swarthmore College, I'm Leo Elliott.
And I'm Gyeongchan Min. The U.S. Senate has approved President Obama's plan to both train and arm Syrian rebel groups to counter ISIS. The $500 million proposal passed the Senate with 78 to 22 votes, a day after the House passed the measure. Saudi Arabia has agreed to host the train and arm program for Syrian rebel groups. On Wednesday, Obama reiterated that the U.S. will not fight another ground war in Iraq, but American troops will be supporting Iraqi forces on the ground. Many senators still have serious doubts about cooperating with Shia militia groups to counter the Sunni ISIS, and it remains unclear if these militias are willing to work with American troops. Kataib Hezbollah, one of the three largest militia groups in Iraq, has announced that it will not work with American troops under any condition. Another group, Asayf al-Haq, declared it would accept American intervention under Iraqi supervision.
ISIS fighters have seized at least 20 Kurdish villages in the Kobani region of Syria since Wednesday. The Islamic State forces used tanks to expand their control over this Kurdish region near the Turkish border. Casualties on both sides have been reported by the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. This recent episode in the ongoing conflict between ISIS and Kurdish militias follows President Obama's announcement last week authorizing airstrikes against ISIS forces in Syria.
More than 800 Australian police conducted raids on Thursday, ultimately uncovering and preventing an ISIS terrorist plot to publicly behead a member of the Australian public. This development comes after Australia raised its terrorist alert level to high, the second highest level possible. This is the first time it has been at that level since the system was implemented in 2003. This week, the Australian government announced its intentions to join the fight against ISIS by sending military advisors to Iraq, deploying fighter jets to the United Arab Emirates, and helping stem the humanitarian crisis.
China's President Xi Jinping has begun an official three-day visit to India. The visit will focus on trade, infrastructure, and border disputes. On Thursday, the two countries announced increased Chinese investment in Indian projects. China will be investing $20 billion in Indian infrastructure over the next 5 years. Both countries stand to gain from increased economic cooperation. Chinese investment will boost Indian infrastructure and job creation, and China serves as a market for Indian pharmaceuticals and IT services. Border disputes remain an unresolved security concern for the two countries. Even as Jinping visits India, both countries are facing off along disputed territory. India remains wary of China expanding its military presence in South Asia.
Over 1,000 protesters wearing all black marched silently and peacefully through Hong Kong this past Sunday. The pro-democracy activists were protesting against Beijing's denial to allow fully democratic elections for its next leader in 2017. Only pro-Beijing candidates are eligible for election. This protest is the second organized by Occupy Central for Love and Peace, a pro-democracy movement that is similar to Occupy Wall Street and has focused on the central financial hub of Hong Kong to advocate for political reform. Amid tensions between pro-establishment forces, pro-democracy activists have organized an unofficial referendum, mass marches, rallies, and an overnight sit-in which resulted in hundreds of arrests. Occupy Central is planning a sit-in protest in Hong Kong's financial center in early October, and later this month, students are expected to boycott classes.
On Wednesday, the United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon expressed his concerns over the slow response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. He announces plans to establish a new on-the-ground mission to help contain the outbreak. As of September 12th, 4,784 cases and 2,400 deaths due to the outbreak have been reported. By the time the virus is contained, which U.S. scientists estimate could take another 12 to 18 months, the number of deaths is estimated to reach 20,000. The U.S. has proposed a draft security resolution calling on member states to provide medical personnel and field hospitals, and suggesting that countries in West Africa keep their borders open and lift any travel restrictions. The resolution states that the Ebola outbreak constitutes a threat to international peace and security. In an effort to contain the virus, the U.S. is preparing to offer medicine, equipment, and up to 3,000 military personnel.
At least 13 people were killed and 35 wounded when gunmen attacked a college in the Nigerian city of Kano on Wednesday. Officials say that the four attackers shot at students in a lecture hall after exchanging fire with police outside campus. One carried explosives that detonated when he was shot by police, injuring bystanders and bringing down the building ceiling. Although no one has taken responsibility for the attack, insurgent Islamist group Boko Haram frequently targets Western-style schools in its fight to establish an Islamic territory in northern Nigeria. Rebel violence against civilians has increased since Nigerian government mounted a military offensive against Boko Haram last year.
Dr. Mohamed Shakil Oj, the Dean of Islamic Studies at the University of Karachi, was killed Thursday morning. Dr. Oj was traveling with friends and family to a reception in his honor when he was shot by an unidentified motorcyclist. In 2012, Dr. Oge filed a complaint with Karachi police after he began receiving death threats following a speech he gave in the United States. Four of his colleagues are currently facing trial for alleged involvement in a text message accusing Dr. Oge of blasphemy, a crime that is punishable by death in Pakistan, and calling for his execution. This killing comes only a week after visiting professor Maulana Masood Baig of the same Islamic Studies department was also shot and killed. Students at Karachi University mounted protests following the killing.
Tensions continue to rise on the Ukrainian border this week after the Russian Defense Minister, Sergei Shoigu, announced an increase in the number of Russian troops in Crimea, blaming what he referred to as, quote, increased presence of foreign military along the border. Shoigu also announced that Russia will consider creating technical missile bases in each of Russia's four military districts. NATO officials, in turn, have warned that increased Russian military presence will undermine the current ceasefire, and Ukraine is currently training 1,300 troops from 15 nations, some NATO members, in a series of military drills codenamed Rapid Trident.
A former member of Hitler's SS unit was charged with 300,000 counts of accessory to murder by German prosecutors this Monday. Gruning, now 93, was stationed as a guard at Auschwitz in 1944. He was responsible for taking money from victims' belongings as they arrived at the concentration camp and sending it to Nazi headquarters. Through his activities, he provided the Nazi regime with economic advantage and supported systematic killing, says the prosecutor's office. Oskar Gruning is one of a group of 30 individuals charged for their involvement with Hitler's SS unit. This trend follows in the wake of a 2011 German landmark ruling that allows charges to be brought against those who held lesser positions in the Nazi regime. Gruning has spoken about his time in Auschwitz and maintains that he did not take part in violence towards the prisoners at the death camp.
If you want to hear more from War News Radio, visit us online at warnewsradio.org. This week's newscast was written and edited by Jay Clayton, Leo Elliott, Amelia Erskine, Allison Raybar, Neymat Kerr, Sabrina Merrill, Jasmine Rodriguez-Schroeder, Jerry Chin, Rachel Sasella, Lily Tyson, and Tyler Welsh. I'm Gyeongchan Min.
And I'm Leo Elliott. Along with our weekly newscast, War News Radio will be releasing additional feature pieces from our show last week, Neighbors. Next up, War News Radio's Sabrina Merrill explores the impact of social media on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Until next time, thanks for listening.
According to Rabbi Daniel Cohen, a blogger for the Times of Israel and my rabbi, social media played a key role in making this summer's Israeli-Palestinian conflict accessible. Rabbi Cohen was in Israel on the American Israel Public Affairs Committee's, APAC's, rabbinic mission to Israel when the conflict commenced. APAC is a pro-Israel lobbying group.
More people than ever are on Facebook and Twitter, and more people than ever are accessing it from their mobile devices. And so they could get images in real time and then share them with the press of a button. And so things can now go viral so much more quickly, and things that are emotionally evocative are going to go viral all the more.
The news travels faster, in part because there are more messengers than ever before. Every day, Israelis and Palestinians can now easily broadcast personal experiences, not just with speed, but with emotional immediacy.
When you remove this layer of New York Times or Washington Post, and you're just hearing the sentences or just the thoughts of people there on the ground, ordinary citizens, and what it's like for them.
That was Abraham Yunus, a junior at Rice University and author of the article, What CNN Never Told You About the Israel-Gaza Conflict. For him, these narratives went viral and had a global impact because of their human quality.
Suddenly, it's no longer statistics, and it's no longer this person reported that, or this foreign policy expert said this. It's, wow, you know, these are just people living, and this is their lives. And so I think it changed people a lot in that sense. A lot of people seem to have changed their opinions.
Human emotions and faces expressed on social media reach people in a way that a New York Times article cannot. Status updates, tweets, and photos allow for an emotional register, says digital media theorist and artist Leila Shireen Sakar.
So it's like you've got this combination of like letter writing and messaging with traditional journalistic publications and mixed together, and that's what you get. So it really does able to connect to capture a public opinion on a really base level. That's what makes a good image. Like a good photograph, like a winning photograph, is because it's telling a whole story in that one shot. And that ability to condense narrative into something like that makes it more powerful.
But everyday users aren't the only ones turning to social media to send out their message. Jed Shine, Digital Advocacy and Strategic Communications at the Embassy of Israel, says Twitter was at the center of their media strategy.
We felt the best way to do that was by having Ambassador Ron Dermer do a Q&A. So it's something that we announced 5 p.m. The night before for something that we, an interview that we were going to do at 9 a.m. the next day. And in that time, there were more than 16,000 tweets up and through the interview engaging on the topic, and the ambassador answered 13 from the toughest critics. The topic trended number one in the United States, number three worldwide, received hundreds of thousands of impressions on Twitter, plus many thousands more offline, off-platform, in various news outlets, or even in some kind of broadcast channels.
This summer, the highest number of social media posts on Gaza came through Instagram. Users on Instagram were visually exposed to war and shared these images on Facebook and Twitter, generating supporters through the power of an image. Layla Shireen Sakar created an audiovisual narrative of all tweets and images with hashtag Gaza to capture and archive its phenomenon.
In terms of the images, I really felt like that with Gaza in particular, it was the images on social media that were making the impact, and I really wanted to draw that out. I was concerned about context. I was like, these are like, just, I felt like it's just dangerously, all these images that are so intense being thrown around. And I didn't know what to make of it. I really didn't know. I look at it, and it's overwhelming all at once. And I wanted people to feel that. I wanted you to see all those images at once.
She is not the only one concerned about context. Here's Rabbi Daniel Cohen, the Times of Israel blogger.
We live in a soundbite society of Twitter with less than 200 characters per tweet. You know, you can't talk about the conflict in the Middle East in 140 characters. You can't just put a picture up on Facebook and say, look what these horrible people did, without having the context of what's going on. It doesn't change the reality for the civilians who were injured or killed. It doesn't lessen that horror. But those facts, I think, matter when you're actually looking at this in a big picture.
It's one thing to retweet without much context, but Cohen says the bigger problem is hate speech.
One of the things that bothered me this summer was that on Facebook, there were a number of pages that said, with titles like, kill all the Zionists and Jews, or something like that. And Facebook allowed these group pages to actually stay. I actually wrote an article in the Times of Israel about it, because I and a number of others sent Facebook notes about the fact that this was hate speech and that it wasn't acceptable according to their standards of behavior. And we got back emails from Facebook saying, this doesn't violate our standards of behavior because there is no direct threat to any individual. So I ended up writing the piece on the day that Facebook took the word standards out of the dictionary. Now, they have since changed their policy. So on the one hand, that was a really bad use of social media initially. And on the other hand, a lot of us were able to actually jump on Facebook about it because we connected with each other over social media. So there's that upside as well.
All of which points to a bigger truth. More voices doesn't necessarily mean more peaceful dialogue. Rice University student Abraham Yunus worries this might be the case.
The internet can be very useful, but I think especially when you have discourse online about this issue, it tends to go nowhere. You just have people kind of either yelling at each other, or you have websites where it's just kind of an echo chamber.
Jed Shine at the Israeli embassy thinks that most of the time we hear predominantly from the polarized extremes on social media.
The people who aren't necessarily engaged or have a strong knowledge or a strong opinion on the topic aren't always the ones that are commenting and making posts on the topic. They're following, they're listening, they're seeing what others are saying, but they may not be the ones to actively speak out. And I think as much as what you see online, you see, I think, the largely polarizing ends, those who have that passion to speak out on a specific topic, but there's a lot of people in the middle who are listening and following and comprehending and absorbing that information and using that to make their own respective opinion.
Facebook and Twitter allow us to connect with high-level officials and real people trapped in the middle of conflict, and to connect at the speed of Wi-Fi. Cohen says that immediacy could be part of the problem.
But I think that everybody needs to slow down somewhat when they're actually posting stuff. So I was going to say social media is a one-way street where you just talk at people, and that's not really true because there can be a conversation. But it's different if you're sitting with the person, you're going back and forth, and you can get the tenor of their voice, and you can get their affect. And it's different when you actually just put out the words.
You can bet that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict won't be the last conflict to go viral. hashtag bring back our girls, hashtag stop Russian aggression, and hashtag Ferguson are just a few topics trending this month. For War News Radio, I'm Sabrina Merrill.